comes from the fact that we want to protect our income. So, emphasis at this point stops eventually on productivity and efficiency. In particular, we want to look at three aspects of efficiency. First thing we want to look at is the overall error rate. Obviously, this is going to be the final bottom line for our efficiency of work. So, if you don't have a good error rate, I guess you're not going to use it. And the second thing we're going to look at is what is the rate of input. Ideally, if you have a communication channel or any channel, either quantum or classical, you like to optimize the capacity of the channel. Another thing which is also very important is the complexity of our error correction schemes. We would like them to be as efficient as possible in the sense that typically they're linear in the length of the code. Now, where does aircraft codes come into picture? Well, protecting information is not a new problem. It is something which the classical coding theories also have dealt with. And it turns out that something which we have learned from classical coding theory is this. If you want to attain all these three metrics, then the kind of codes we have to look are codes which have a very good graphical structure. In fact, these codes permit decoding algorithms and graphs. And the ones I'm going to look at as called low density parity check codes, shortened usually called LDPC codes. And these codes can allow us to attain error rates fairly close to zero, in fact, arguably close to zero, especially as you increase the length of the code. And you can also attain rates that can be made very close to capacity. That's why they're also called capacity achieving codes. And one important thing about these codes is that they have a linear complexity of decoding. Now, since these codes have been there for quite some time, there were initial attempts to use these kinds of codes to build quantum error correction codes. But so far, we have not had a true success in building these codes. And even this talk is not really a final say on this, but hopefully give some kind of new perspective on how to solve the problems with these codes. I'm going to assume that all of you are fully familiar with the stabilizer codes, and so this is just the notation. It's like stabilizer code is simply a joint ideal space of all is a group in on n qubits. Now we know that stabilizer codes can be constructed from classical codes. In this talk, I'm going to restrict myself to one particular construction, that is the TSS construction, where we construct from classical codes that contain residuals. We have already seen how stabilizer codes can be constructed from graph codes in the topological box. Now, what we are going to do is use bipartite graphs to construct stabilizer codes. In particular, we are going to look at stabilizer, or the representation of stabilizer in this particular form, where H is the parity check matrix of the classical code. The main restriction that we have on the classical code is that its parity check matrix must satisfy its function. H into H transport is equal to zero. But why bipartite graphs? Well, it's a natural way to associate a code to a bipartite graph. Given a parity check matrix of this form, it has a length which is equal to the number of the columns of the code, and the number of rows correspond to the redundancy of the code. It is actually equal to n minus k. K is your information which are stored. And the way to associate a graph is this. We form a left in the number of left nodes in the graph are precisely equal to the number of the columns, and the number of right nodes are equal to the number of the rows. The connectivity of this graph is determined by the H matrix. For instance, in this particular case, this particular row indicates that the first right node is connected to the first and the third nodes. Now, the reason why this graphical representation is useful is because when we want to decode our codes, typically we have our information coming on the left side, and we have it corrupted by probably some error E. What we have to solve is, we have a syndrome which can be computed based on the H matrix. In a quantum case, we have a syndrome which is measured. So we don't have direct access to the nodes themselves, but they correspond to these right nodes. And given these syndrome measurements, we have to estimate the error which has occurred on these qubit nodes. And one way to do it is either use a lookup table or any other kind of such algorithm. But the better way to do it is let each of these qubit nodes form a local estimate of their error, and then communicate that local estimate to the syndrome nodes. Only to the nodes which they are connected. And the syndrome nodes are going to check if the estimate satisfies the measured syndrome. If that is the case, then they'll send messages back to the qubit nodes, whether to update or refine their estimates. Now, the repeated iteration there, as we keep making more and more rounds, gradually the estimate of the qubit nodes regarding the error keeps getting refined more and more. And under certain properties of the graph, we can actually crunch the actual error that has occurred. Now, there are few important issues for this decoding algorithm to work. Now, the decoding algorithm proceeds in rounds. In the first round, when there are messages sent from the qubit nodes to the syndrome nodes, and in the half of that round, the syndrome nodes send messages back to the qubit nodes. But there is one important requirement here, and that is that the messages that a node sends, let's say in this case the qubit node to the syndrome node, must be independent of the message that it has received from that node. Only then can the decoding algorithm proceed properly. It can, only then the estimates will get refined. Now, this assumption actually translates to the fact that the girth of the graph, in other words, that the smallest cycle in the graph is very large. Only then the messages that are received here have can satisfy the independence assumption. But when we try to do the same thing with the quantum error correcting codes, take a bipartite graph, and before that, let me just back up. Why is this good in terms of complexity? Well, the number of messages you send from left to right or right to left is proportional to the number of edges. So if you keep the edge count proportional to the length of the node, number of nodes, then you can end up with a low complexity decoding algorithm. So if you try to do the same thing for quantum error correcting codes, we have to run into one small problem. And that is, in order to satisfy the fact that the H matrix, H into H transpose is equal to zero, if it's a non-trivial stabilizer code, we end up with a lot of 4 cycles. The girth of the graph is going to be 4. And in many cases, the number of 4 cycles are very large, a very number. So how do we solve this problem? That means all the messages are fairly going to be correlated between 2 rounds, and the estimates will not get refined very well. So one possible solution is we can try to do redundant decoding on the graphs. In fact, this idea came up earlier in the context of classical LDPC codes, when people were studying algebraic LDPC codes. And the motivation there was, typically in order to achieve good performance, the length of the code is fairly large. And they wanted to look at cases where the H matrix has a lot of structure, so you could use less memory to store. And so I'll just briefly give a kind of introduction to these finite geometries. These are simply a collection of points and lines, and they have certain, these 4 axioms which must be satisfied. 2 of them are pretty obvious. One of them says that any 2 lines either intersect or they don't intersect. If they intersect only at one point. The other one is, between any 2 points, you can just draw one line. These other 2 axioms specify that given one any line or any line, it has a fixed number of points. And every point lies on a precise number of lines, say gamma. With these 4 axioms, we can end up with only 2 possible finite geometries. One of them is the Euclidean geometry, other one is the projective geometry. We will restrict ourselves to the Euclidean geometry in this case. It has much more easier to handle, so it can be identified over n-dimensional vector space over a finite field. So how do we get codes from here. So first, let us look at an example. It will become clear. If we look at a two-dimensional finite geometry, the four points, then you can draw the six lines for this particular geometry. And we have to form what is known as an incidence graph. And associated to that is, let us take this particular line, L1. Now, we can associate what is known as an incidence vector for this line. This line, this incidence vector tells us which points of this geometry lie on this line. In this particular case, the origin and the point 1, 0 lie on this, right? Now, in order to form the incidence matrix or the incidence graph, we form the incidence vectors of all the lines in the geometry. And then we form our matrix. Now you can see there are only four points, but it has more than four rows, right? These rows, columns correspond to our cubic nodes, and these will correspond to our checks. And we will use this to form our edge matrix or our graph. Now, why is it going to be sparse? It will become a little bit more Alexandrian later. But this is how we are going to get our finite geometry. But in order to use quantum error correcting, use for quantum error correcting codes, we also have to have an additional constraint that H into H transpose should be equal to 0. So to go to that, get those kind of incident graphs, we have to go one more level. And that is, instead of using the incident structures coming from lines and points, we have to now look at hyperplanes and the incident structures associated with them. And if we do that, then we get incident structures slightly more complicated. But even then, that is not enough because we have to guarantee that H into H transpose condition is satisfied. And this is probably going to be a little bit more confusing kind of slide, but I'll try to explain a little bit. Assume that we have obtained a graph code using finite geometry over a higher dimensional plane. Then, if this is our LVDC code, and this is the code that is generated by H. Now, it's not easy to find out when this particular subcode is going to sit here. So, what we are going to do is this. We're going to embed this code in a higher field, a code over a higher field, which is a generalized Dream Muller code. Why do we do that? Because these Dream Muller codes have very nice properties. The duals of Dream Muller codes are also Dream Muller codes. And then there's a theorem by Delsarte which gives a very nice relationship that you can go to this higher field code and then go one more level to its dual code, and then you can come down to a trace operation to the LVDC code. So if you do this, then it's easy to find where this code will sit inside this code. The only condition that needs to be satisfied is the order of this Dream Muller code is less than the order of this Dream Muller code. So when you do that, you can actually have this kind of relationship between the codes, and we end up with our two codes satisfying the condition that they have a dual containing finite geometry code. But if you do that, we have this relationship or this theorem which tells when quantum LVDC codes will exist. And we can compute the dimension based on the dimension of this code and the distance of this code. So I'll give an example and show how exactly these codes are going to perform. And one simple code which is going to be considered is this code over a three-dimensional geometry over F8. And this geometry has 512 points, and if you consider two-dimensional planes, 584 of them, and since I satisfy these conditions given in the previous theorem, we can end up with a code which is having a fairly high rate of 384 and a fairly large distance. But how does this perform? This is the block error rate of this code as plotted with respect to the probability of error in a default vector. Now, you can see that it is going down, and in fact, these codes have one nice property. In the sense that they don't show up, the error rate doesn't flag you as you keep increasing, as you keep reading the problem interpreter, which is a problem with some of the random elements. But the more important thing is this. This particular code has more than 50 million foci cycles. So the important takeaway from, I would say, from this kind of course is that even though foci cycles have been thought to be very catastrophic for our LDPC course or quantum LDPC course, we can still find a way to work around them, and we can still ensure our decoding, iterative decoding works, in spite of the fact that the information or the messages get correlated across the decoding rounds. But is there any problem? There is one problem, however, with this course, and that is, even though they give very high rates, the complexity of decoding is not entirely linear. The decoding complexity can increase to the slightly higher than 10. And this is because we have to use higher dimensional planes, and they might have a large degree. But the important thing, like I said earlier, is that we can now probably use this method for other codes. Maybe we can try to use iterative decoding in other graph codes. But this is a problem, right? Large degree. So in the next portion of the talk, I'm going to try to address how to keep the degree low and still be able to get good error rates. For this, we need the idea of subsystems. Now we have already seen in stabilized approach, we encode our information with this inverse system inverse space. It is decomposed into the code space and an orthogonal complement. In case of subsystem codes, we will put an additional restriction on the code space and decompose it to the tensor product of two subspaces. And we put our information only on T. The reason why we do it is we hope to simplify our decoding mechanism by using this additional subsystem, which is also called the gate subsystem. And these dimensions of these codes are indicated also in when you specify the parameters of the subsystem. So when we look at all the errors that act non-trivially on A, we call them the gauge group. Typically, when we look at stabilizer codes, we just look at the stabilizer. But it turns out when you want to study subsystem codes, we need to look at the gauge group also. And this particular group will actually be used to us when we construct this graph code. Now, we are going to look at a lattice. It need not be square lattice, it can be rectangular lattice. This course was originally proposed by Blake and Casaccino. And they use any classical LDPC code, any classical code, which is concatenated twice to construct this subsystem code. The important thing about this class of codes is that the gauge group has a very nice structure. If you start with the classical code of parity matrix, then it consists of both only x only and z only operators, and they can be given dual in terms of h. And the stabilizer also can be dual in terms of h and the generative matrix. Now, if you just look at from the point of view of this sense, so even if you start with a very good classical code, you can end up with a plot that is asymptotically bad with respect to distance. So you might think these are not really good codes, we can't use them. But we can somehow work around if you just take our focus from distance and focus on the fact that the error rate is what we really want. So how are we going to do it? Essentially, there are four ideas that we're going to use. First thing is that we are going to reduce the support of the errors using the gauge code. What do I mean by that? A typical error can be anywhere within this lattice of n square qubits. Because the fact that the gauge code does not affect the information subsystem, we can factor the errors in some of the rows and some of the columns. What we are going to do is, using the gauge group, focus our attention only on the first k columns and only in the first k rows. And the second thing you're going to do is We're going to split the errors. What does that mean? We are going to, let's assume we have reduced the support of the error to these k rows. Then, once again, we are going to say we are going to split the error four of k independent rows. So the error is of being having to be estimated over the entire big support of k rows. We'll estimate rho by rho. And then we're going to measure compute the sink rows in parts. Because if you just look at the gauge stabilizer, typically this could be a large weight generator. And you don't want to measure it in one shot. But with the help of the gauge group, we can split this measurement of the syndrome into parts which have low complexity, which might be useful in terms of fault tolerance. And the last ingredient which we're going to need is that we have to look at classical faults, which are what is called a non-trivial error experiment. And I'll explain it's actually the positive error experiment that we want to look at. So let me explain how, for instance, we could reduce the support of the errors from two k columns. We have seen the gauge group in one case consists of all H matrices in this particular form. Now, on the H matrix itself, is we can always put in this particular standard, what is known as the standard. So this, you can see that this corresponds to first row, second row, and so on. And because H is in this form, if there is an error on the last n minus k columns, we can shift that error to the first k columns by appropriately multiplying by an element of the gauge group. So this is how we can shift the errors so that the support is only in k columns or k rows. Now, how do we split it? Well, if you look at the element of the stabilizer generator, it is typically of consists of elements from this matrix. Now, we said we can always move an error in the last k columns to the first k columns. The last element is k columns to the first k columns. Now, if you have this nice structure, because if an error occurs in this row, it doesn't get affected by these stabilizer generators. All you need to look at is this top row, or top k and n minus k generators. So we can compute the sink row of estimate error purely from this k rows separately. And the decoding complex is just going to be k times the decoding complexity of this. So if you have a classical LBP support, which is very good, and linear decoding complexity, then the overall complexity is still going to be n squared, the length of the classical, but it's still linear in the length of the quantum. Now, we can also choose H to have constant weight. In that case, our syndrome measurement is also going to be of a constant complexity. So in this case, I illustrate how we can get a syndrome measurement in parts. And the basic idea is the typical generator is of this form. So what we do is we measure the gauge group elements separately and then combine them classically to get the syndrome measurement. This idea has been used earlier by Alifaris and Dayton for finding the threshold, improving the threshold of a subsystem, Dayton subsystem. So what is the overall error rate of this code? Now, if you, because we have k rows to be decoded and k columns to be decoded, and then because they're being decoded differently, you can upper bound the overall quantum error rate by 2k times the error rate of the classical code. And this is just a factor to make sure it's an upper bound and not a lower bound. And if we have this, we want to make this parameter to go to zero. So how do we make that? Well, this is going to increase the overall error rate of the classical code by a factor of k, right? Now, k is obviously less than n. So, if you have a good classical code, which has a very good error exponent, at least that's positive, in other words, it means that the error rate goes down if you increase the length exponentially. So, it needs to be e only used to a small positive constant. And this is going to be slowed down by log n factor. So in, when we increase length as n tends to infinity, this additional slowdown because of this 2k factor is not going to affect. So we can still end up with an asymptotically good thing. Even though we started out with the code which seemed to be bad in the sense of distance. So do such codes exist? Well, there are some problems here in the sense that the error exponents are difficult to compute. But we know the error exponents for codes based on expanded graphs. And they have positive error exponents. So if we use, and we can view them as a class of LDP scores in terms of interactions. And these codes have linear decoding complexity. So if you use these codes, we can end up with a class of codes which are asymptotically good, whose error rates go to zero, and whose rates are non is also good in the sense k over n, k over the length of the code is a constant. In fact, you don't have to use any LDP score for that matter. Any possible code with a positive error exponent in this strategy is going to work. So more interesting idea would be to use other classes of codes with positive error exponents. So to sum up, would like to suggest that even though constructing sparse graph quantum codes is a difficult problem in itself because of the four cycle problem, we might be able to alleviate the problem by using redundant parity checks. And perhaps we could even try them for in topological codes as redundant syndrome measurements and then try to do iterative decoding on it. And we can use the page group to break down the reduce the complexity of syndrome measurements. And we need to probably shift our focus from distance to the error rate so that we can get better codes. So that's all sums up what I have to say.
You still have the need to put the code in dual. Yes, you're still dual containing codes.
So yeah, but we can relax that constraint. We can relax that constraint by looking at slightly broader class of finite geometry by taking incident structures from two hyperplanes and then use those.
Then it doesn't have to be in dual.
Yeah, but it might still be a CSS based code. And if you go for non-binary aspects, then maybe we can use a general GF4 and not sorry, we may have to go away from CSS construction.
Yeah. And then the other question is, if these expand the code, are they of this type?
Yeah, they are. I mean, their error exponents have been shown to be positive. In a recent work, I think 2002 by Alexander and Bard, I forget the name of the question.
Okay, so your earlier code, well, this is, you've been considering codes for storing information. Of course, there is another question, computation. Can you do computation based on these codes? And then, of course, what becomes very important is transversality of gates. Now, on your busy slide, you had the remodel codes there, so you were massaging remodel codes.
Right.
And some of these codes have very nice transversality properties, namely that sort of non-clipper gates. Non-clipper gates can be performed transversally. So have you looked whether that property carries over to the codes you've been constructing?
These are non-binary
remodel codes. Oh, non-binary.
This particular code is the binary subcoding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I have not looked into detail whether the follow-up and properties.
Okay.
So have you considered using entanglement assistance to enlarge in the space of quantum codes that you might look at to find structures that have large positive exponents, or just positive exponents, I guess, that might help you come up with new kinds of sparse graph quantum codes?
No, but I think the error exponent is a property of the code by itself.
The classical code?
Classical.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you can change it by using entanglement.
Well, I guess with entanglement assistance, you can realize any classical code as a quantum code, whereas otherwise you have to have this dual containing property quantum code. And so I was wondering if there's things known about classical codes that you just don't allow yourself to access because of this dual containing restriction, even with this larger space here that you're using.
No, I have not used entanglement. In this case, is the use of entanglement. But the thing which I feel about entanglement assistant codes is that the amount of entanglement which you have used is determined by the intersection of the code with this dual. And that is not always under control. So that might be a problem with using entanglement assistant. Whereas in a self-orthogonal code, you don't have the problem because it's empty. You don't have to have, you have zero entanglement.
Right.
Okay, so let's time for the again. The end of this great workshop. So please join me to thank our